Chapter 16. Abstract figure, more or less himself, was steeping his mind in a sublimation of the arts and sciences, and making his calling and election sure to a seat in the paradise of the learned. He was set regarding his prospects in a cold northern light. He had lately felt that he could not quite satisfy himself in his Greek and the Greek of the dramatists particularly. So fatigued was he sometimes after his day's work, that he could not maintain the critical attention necessary for thorough application. He felt that he wanted a coach, a friend at his elbow, to tell him in a moment what sometimes would occupy him a weary month in extracting from an anticipative clumsy books. It was decidedly necessary to consider facts a little more closely than he had done of late. What was the good, after all, of using up his spare hours in a vague labor called private study without giving an outlook on practicabilities? I ought to have thought of this before, he said, as he journeyed back. It would have been better never to have embarked in the scheme at all than to do it without seeing clearly where I am going, or what I am aiming at. This hovering outside the walls of the colleges, as if expecting some arm to be stretched out from them to lift me inside, won't do. I must get special information. The next week accordingly he sought it. What at first seemed an opportunity occurred one afternoon, when he saw an elderly gentleman, who had been pointed out as the head of a particular college, walking in the public path of a park-like enclosure near the spot at which Jude chanced to be sitting. The gentleman came nearer, and Jude looked anxiously at his face. It seemed benign, considerate, yet rather reserved. On second thoughts, Jude felt that he could not go up and address him, but he was sufficiently influenced by the incident to think what a wise thing it would be for him to state his difficulties by letter to some of the best and most judicious of these old masters, and obtain their advice. During the next week or two he accordingly placed himself in such positions about the city as would afford him glimpses of several of the most distinguished among the provosts, wardens, and other heads of houses, and from those he ultimately selected five whose physiognomies seemed to say to him that they were appreciative and far-seeing men. To these five he addressed letters, briefly stating his difficulties, and asking their opinion on his stranded situation. When the letters were posted, Jude mentally began to criticize them. He wished they had not been sent. He is just one of those intrusive, vulgar, pushing applications which are so common in these days, he thought. Why couldn't I know better than address other strangers in such a way? I may be an impostor, an idle scamp, a man with a bad character, for all that they know to the contrary. Perhaps that's what I am. Nevertheless, he found himself clinging to the hope of some reply as to his one last chance of redemption. He waited day after day, saying that it was perfectly absurd to expect, yet expecting. While he waited, he was suddenly stirred by news about Phillotson. Phillotson was giving up the school near Christminster for a larger one further south, in mid-Wessex. What this meant, how it would affect his cousin, whether, as seemed possible, it was a practical move of the schoolmaster's towards a larger income, in view of a provision for two instead of one, he would not allow himself to say. And the tender relations between Phillotson and the young girl of whom Jude was passionately enamored effectually made it repugnant to Jude's tastes to apply to Phillotson for advice on his own scheme. Meanwhile, the academic dignitaries to whom Jude had written vouchsafed no answer, and the young man was thus thrown back entirely on himself, as formerly, with the added gloom of a weakened hope. By indirect inquiries he soon perceived clearly what he had long uneasily suspected, that to qualify himself for certain open scholarships and exhibitions was the only brilliant course. But to do this a good deal of coaching would be necessary, and much natural ability. It was next to impossible that a man reading on his own system, however widely and thoroughly, even over the prolonged period of 10 years, should be able to compete with those who had passed their lives under trained teachers, and had worked to ordained lines. The other course, that of buying himself in, so to speak, seemed the only one really open to men like him, the difficulty being simply of a material kind. With the help of his information, he began to reckon the extent of this material obstacle, and ascertained, to his dismay, that, at the rate at which, with the best of fortune, he would be able to save money, 15 years must elapse before he could be in a position to forward testimonials to the head of a college and advance to a matriculation examination. The undertaking was hopeless. He saw what a curious and cunning glamour the neighborhood of the place had exercised over him. To get there and live there, to move among the churches and halls, and become imbued with the genius loci, had seemed to his dreaming youth, as the spot shaped its charms to him from its halo on the horizon, the obvious and ideal thing to do. Let me only get there, he had said with the fatuousness of Crusoe over his big boat, and the rest is but a matter of time and energy. It would have been far better for him in every way, if he had never come within sight and sound of the deluge of precincts, had gone to some busy commercial town with the sole object of making money by his wits, and then surveyed his plan in true perspective. Well, all that was clear to him amounted to this, that the whole scheme had burst up, like an iridescent soap bubble, under the touch of a reasoned inquiry. He looked back at himself along the vista of his past years, and his thought was akin to Haynes. Above the youth's inspired and flashing eyes I see the motley mocking fool's cap rise. Fortunately he had not been allowed to bring his disappointment into his dear Sue's life, by involving her in this collapse. And the painful details of his awakening to a sense of his limitations should now be spared her as far as possible. After all, as he had only known a little part of the miserable struggle in which he had been engaged thus unequipped, poor, and unforeseeing. He always remembered the appearance of the afternoon on which he awoke from his dream. Not quite knowing what to do with himself, he went up to an octagonal chamber in the lantern of a singularly built theater that was set amidst this quaint and singular city. It had windows all round, from which an outlook over the whole town and its edifices could be gained. Jude's eyes swept all the views in succession, meditatively, mournfully, yet sturdily. Those buildings and their associations and privileges were not for him. From the looming roof of the great library, into which he hardly ever had time to enter, his gaze traveled onto the varied spires, halls, gables, streets, chapels, gardens, quadrangles, which composed the ensemble of this unrivaled panorama. He saw that his destiny lay not with these, but among the manual toilers in the shabby purlieu which he himself occupied, unrecognized as part of the city at all by its visitors and panegyrists, yet without whose denizens the hard readers could not read nor the high thinkers live. He looked over the town into the country beyond, to the trees which screened her whose presence had at first been the support of his heart, and whose loss was now a maddening torture. But for this blow he might have borne with his fate. With Sue as companion he could have renounced his ambitions with a smile. Without her it was inevitable that the reaction from the long strain to which he had subjected himself should affect him disastrously. Phillotson had no doubt passed through a similar intellectual disappointment to that which now enveloped him. But the schoolmaster had been since blessed with the consolation of sweet Sue, while for him there was no consoler. Descending to the streets, he went listlessly along till he arrived at an inn, and entered it. Here he drank several glasses of beer in rapid succession, and when he came out it was night. By the light of the flickering lamps he rambled home to supper, and had not long been sitting at table, when his landlady brought up a letter that had just arrived for him. She laid it down, as if impressed with a sense of its possible importance, and on looking at it Jude perceived that it bore the embossed stamp of one of the colleges whose heads he had addressed. "Northeast at last!" cried Jude. The communication was brief, and not exactly what he had expected, though it really was from the master in person. It ran thus: Biblioteca College. Sir, I have read your letter with interest, and, judging from your description of yourself as a working man, I venture to think that you will have a much better chance of success in life by remaining in your own sphere and sticking to your trade than by adopting any other course. That, therefore, is what I advise you to do. Yours faithfully, T. Tuffany. Oh, Mr. J. Folly, Stonemason. This terribly sensible advice exasperated Jude. He had known all that before. He knew it was true. Yet it seemed a hard slap after 10 years of labor, and its effect upon him just now was to make him rise recklessly from the table, and, instead of reading as usual, to go downstairs, and into the street. He stood at a bar and tossed off 2 or 3 glasses, then unconsciously sauntered along till he came to a spot called the Four Ways in the middle of the city, gazing abstractedly at the groups of people like one in a trance, till, coming to himself, he began talking to the policeman fixed there. That officer yawned, stretched out his elbows, elevated himself an inch and a half on the balls of his toes, smiled, and looking humorously at Jude, said, "You've had a wet, young man." "No, I've only begun," he replied cynically. Whatever his wetness, his brains were dry enough. He only heard in part the policeman's further remarks, having fallen into thought on what struggling people like himself had stood at that crossway, whom nobody ever thought of now. It had more history than the oldest college in the city. It was literally teeming, stratified, with the shades of human groups, who had met there for tragedy, comedy, farce, real enactments of the intensest kind. At Four Ways men had stood and talked of Napoleon, the loss of America, the execution of King Charles, the burning of the martyrs, the Crusades, the Norman conquest, possibly of the arrival of Caesar. Here the two sexes had met for loving, hating, coupling, parting, had waited, had suffered for each other, had triumphed over each other, cursed each other in jealousy, blessed each other in forgiveness. He began to see that the town life was a book of humanity infinitely more palpitating, varied, and compendious than the gown life. These struggling men and women before him were the reality of Christminster, though they knew little of Christ or Minster. That was one of the humors of things. The floating population of students and teachers, who did know both in a way, were not Christminster in a local sense at all. He looked at his watch, and, in pursuit of this idea, he went on till he came to a public hall, where a promenade concert was in progress. Jude entered, and found the room full of shop youths and girls, soldiers, apprentices, boys of 11 smoking cigarettes, and light women of the more respectable and amateur class. He had tapped the real Christminster life. A band was playing, and the crowd walked about, and jostled each other, and every now and then a man got upon a platform, and sang a comic song. The spirit of Sue seemed to hover around him, and prevent his flirting and drinking with the frolicsome girls who made advances wistful, to gain a little joy. At 10 o'clock he came away, choosing a circuitous route homeward to pass the gates of the college whose head had just sent him the note. The gates were shut, and, by an impulse, he took from his pocket the lump of chalk which as a workman he usually carried there, and wrote along the wall, "I have understanding as well as you, I am not inferior to you. Yea, who knoweth not such things as these? Jobziah. 3. Via, the stroke of scorn relieved his mind, and the next morning he laughed at his self-conceit. But the laugh was not a healthy one. He reread the letter from the master, and the wisdom in its lines, which had at first exasperated him, chilled and depressed him now. He saw himself as a fool indeed. Deprived of the objects of both intellect and emotion, he could not proceed to his work. Whenever he felt reconciled to his fate as a student, there came to disturb his calm his hopeless relations with Sue. That the one affined soul he had ever met was lost to him through his marriage returned upon him with cruel persistency, till, unable to bear it longer, he again rushed for distraction to the real Christminster life. He now sought it out in an obscure and low-sailed tavern up a court which was well known to certain worthies of the place, and in brighter times would have interested him simply by its quaintness. Here he sat more or less all the day, convinced that he was at bottom a vicious character, of whom it was hopeless to expect anything. In the evening the frequenters of the house dropped in one by one, Jude still retaining his seat in the corner, though his money was all spent, and he had not eaten anything the whole day except a biscuit. He surveyed his gathering companions with all the equanimity and philosophy of a man who has been drinking long and slowly, and made friends with several. To wit, Tinker Taylor, a decayed church ironmonger who appeared to have been of a religious turn in earlier years, but was somewhat blasphemous now, also a red-nosed auctioneer, also two Gothic masons like himself, called Uncle Jim and Uncle Joe. There were present, too, some clerks, and a gown and surplice maker's assistant, two ladies who sported moral characters of various depths of shade, according to their company, nicknamed O.R.O. Bliss and Reckles, some horsey men and the know of betting circles, a traveling actor from the theater, and two devil-may-care young men who proved to be gownless undergraduates. They had slipped in by stealth, to meet a man about bullpups, and stayed to drink, and smoke short pipes with the racing gents aforesaid, looking at their watches every now and then. The conversation waxed general. Christminster society was criticized, the dons, magistrates, and other people in authority being sincerely pitied for their shortcomings, while opinions on how they ought to conduct themselves, and their affairs to be properly respected, were exchanged in a large-minded and disinterested manner. Jude Folly, with the self-conceit, effrontery, and aplomb of a strong-brained fellow in liquor, threw in his remarks somewhat peremptorily, and his aims having been what they were for so many years, everything the others said turned upon his tongue, by a sort of mechanical craze, to the subject of scholarship and study, the extent of his own learning being dwelt upon with an insistence that would have appeared pitiable to himself in his sane hours. "I don't care a damn," he was saying, "for any provost, warden, principal, fellow, or cursed master of arts in the university. What I know is that I'd lick 'em on their own ground if they'd give me a chance and show 'em a few things they are not up to yet." "Hear, hear," said the undergraduates from the corner where they were talking privately about the pups. "You always was fond o' books, I've heard," said Tinker Taylor, "and I don't doubt what you state. Now with me 'twas different. I always saw there was more to be learned outside a book than in, and I took my steps accordingly, or I shouldn't have been the man I am." "You aim at the church, I believe?" said Uncle Joe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.